So the concerts are November 17th and 18th. That's this Friday and Saturday evening, 8 o'clock p.m. at the Toledo Museum of Art Peristyle, which is a beautiful theater, by the way. Have you been out in this neck of the woods?
No, actually, I've played all over Ohio, of course, but this will be my debut with the Toledo Symphony, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're looking forward as well. I thought it would be nice for folks to get a little background on you and your experience with this particular concerto, the Brahms Violin Concerto, and also if you can talk, why don't we start talking about your violin, because it's a magnificent instrument, and Brahms himself had a hand in choosing this. Can you tell the story behind that, please?
Indeed, yes. So I'm very lucky to have the lifetime loan of a gorgeous instrument from Cremona, Italy, the 1742 ex-soldat Guarneri del Gesu. Guarneri and Stradivari are considered to be the two greatest violin makers ever, and it's just kind of a matter of taste which one you prefer. Guarneri's tend to be very deep and dark and rich sounding, and Stradivari's are more sweeter, creamier tone, but many great artists of the past have preferred the Del Gesu sound, such as Paganini, who also had a 1742 Guarneri, and Isaac Stern, and Fritz Kreisler, and Izay, and Heifetz, and so there are fewer than a tenth as many Del Gesu in the world as there are Strads. So anyway, this particular Guarneri, like many of the antique instruments, has a nickname. The nickname is often somebody who either owned it or played it or both. In this case, it was a player like myself who was not the owner. Marie Soldat was a wonderful violin soloist of the 19th century, one of the women violin soloists, which is really interesting. And she was discovered as a teenager by Brahms. She was from Austria, and he heard her play one day and flipped out and brought her to meet his best friend and collaborator, Joseph Joachim, the great soloist and pedagogue for whom Brahms wrote the violin concerto. And both of those gentlemen became mentors to Marie Soldat for the remainder of their lives. And she was part of Brahms's inner circle of chamber musicians, and they frequently played together. She was one of the first champions of the Brahms Violin Concerto. For example, the first concert, the world premiere in Berlin, Brahms conducted and Joachim played the solo part. The second concert in Berlin, Joachim conducted and Marie Soldat played the solo part, and she also gave it its Vienna premiere and many other European cities. So it's fascinating to realize that Marie Soldat was one of the earliest performers of the Brahms Violin Concerto with Brahms's blessing, and that on this side of the ocean, Maude Powell championed the Brahms Concerto. And in fact, in celebration of the 150th anniversary of the birth of Maude Powell this year, her sesquicentennial, I will actually be performing not my own cadenza as I usually do, nor the famous one by Joachim, but I will be performing Maude Powell's cadenza for the Brahms Concerto. Marie Soldat played Joachim's and never wrote her own. But anyway, back to the violin. At a certain point in her career, Marie Soldat had gotten to the level of accomplishment that she really needed a great instrument to, voice her artistry with. And, even back then, these things could be out of the price range of what an artist might be able to afford. So Brahms found an aristocratic family who agreed to buy an instrument for Marie Soldat's use, and Brahms himself selected this very violin. So it's amazing to think that, he must have at least subconsciously had his music in mind. Of course, it sounds gorgeous on any repertoire, but it sounds particularly perfect for the music of Brahms. And it's also amazing to think that they played chamber music together, meaning Brahms was sitting at the piano and Marie Soldat was playing this violin. So it means my violin got to jam with Brahms.
That's just remarkable. How does that make you feel when you pick that up and you play the music of Brahms, knowing that he heard the violin and he had a hand in selecting that violin?
Yeah, well, just, any violin, it's like holding a piece of history, but knowing that this one passed through the hands of Antonio Bazzini earlier in the century and then Marie Soldat, and it's just so inspiring. It also sets the bar high because I know the violin can do it, so if anything isn't going right, I know it must be my fault. But usually the violin helps get me there, so there's never any problem. And anything I can envision for this music, it's all absolutely right there at my fingertips in terms of tonal colors. And honestly, the violin, even though I've been playing it now since 2002, and I'll tell you about that in a sec, but even though it's, you know, we've had a 15-year relationship thus far, I still feel like I'm discovering, you know, new nuances and subtleties, and, you know, there's more depth to explore. So it's continually inspiring me. And, yeah, the reason I first received the use of it myself, I was borrowing, you know, antique instruments since I won my gold medal when I was 17. After that, I received my first long-term loan of an instrument and went from an Amati to a Strad to another Guarneri. And this one came into my hands because I was about to record the Brahms Violin Concerto with my hometown orchestra, the Chicago Symphony. And somebody I knew the owner of this violin and said, would you like to play an instrument related to Brahms for your recording? And I said, well, that sounds pretty awesome. And so I played this violin and absolutely fell in love with it. And then I didn't want to give it back. And luckily the owner liked me and decided I could keep using it, and the rest is history.
Yeah, all's well that ends well.
Indeed.
We're talking with Rachel Barton Pine, the violinist who is performing, making her debut with Toledo Symphony this weekend. Wonderful concerts. Performing the Brahms Violin Concerto, which really is a staple of the repertoire. You've been playing this for quite a while, haven't you? When did you first pick up that concerto?
Oh, gosh. It was in my mid-teens, and then when I was 17 and 18, I used it for all of my important international competitions in Europe, and then I subsequently made many of my important debuts with this concerto. So it's been, you know, maybe my signature piece. I hate to go that far because I love every other concerto, but if you ask the question, you know, you have an hour left to live and you can only play one last concerto, what's it going to be? I would have to say the Brahms. So, you know, I don't like to use the word favorite when it comes to any music because I love so much of it, but the Brahms has a very special place in my heart. And actually, I was very lucky to have the opportunity to study it in Berlin at the end of his life with Werner Schulze, who was professor in East Berlin. And then, you know, right after the wall came down, you know, we Westerners had the opportunity to learn from him and, you know, gain some wisdom because he, Werner Schulze, Professor Schulze, was a student of Joachim.
Wow.
So a direct line. He, in my lessons, he would say, my teacher said that Joachim said that Brahms said to play it like this. And so you can't argue with that.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to hear these stories, you know, as close to firsthand as is possible.
Do you do any teaching, or do you have time to work with other violinists?
That's a great question. I've avoided taking on a full-time professorship all these years. I actually had a studio way back at the beginning of my career, and then, you know, the touring got too intense and I gave it up. And I definitely miss those relationships and guiding particular young people every week and seeing their gradual progress. And that's just so rewarding, and getting to know them as people. My old students are still some of my close friends, but you know, I'm just on the road so much, and there's so much going on. So I teach continually. I mean, I give master classes everywhere I go. I'm doing two in Toledo this weekend.
Wow.
And I frequently give supplemental lessons to other people's students or to post-grad students. But, yeah, having the commitment to seeing my own class every 7 days, it's just not going to happen right now when I'm literally never home.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question that relates to a podcast that we do with Toledo Symphony. We have done an episode about Dvorak's New World Symphony, which is also on the program. And I'm just curious to get your point of view as to American music. And, you know, do you have any opinions as to what kind of music defines the American sound, if any?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, and I've thought about this a lot because I have friends coming from the traditional music world who talk a lot about American music and so on. And certainly I think it's, you know, fascinating that there are regional styles, you know, that the fiddling of the Northeast is different from the fiddling of Texas and things like that. And then, of course, you have, you know, much more recent styles. As a Chicagoan, I grew up with Chicago blues, which is slightly different from other blues. And I can't explain it exactly. I can't articulate it, not being a blues scholar. But I know it when I hear it, and I'm always right. And then, of course, more recently, you know, Chicago was where house music was invented. It was also part of my teenage musical life. But, you know, as far as classical music, you know, one could almost argue that any style of music from the entire planet could be American music, because we're this wonderful melting pot. And if we have, you know, an Estonian community or a Filipino community or whatever it might be, and they come to America and they are now Americans and they're playing their music, this music, in a way, one could argue that it is now American music. And so that's a really interesting thought, you know, that America is all music. And so, but then what is there any unique music that's American music? And of course, one of the big things that my foundation does is research on Black classical composers from throughout the African diaspora, but particularly concentrated as far as African American composers. And much African American music or music by Black composers from elsewhere, whether it's Latin America or Europe or whatever, much of that music, of course, sounds like any other classical music of its time and place. It's romantic music, or it's atonal contemporary music, or, you know, classical period European music. But there is certainly a wonderful body of repertoire that draws upon uniquely African-American musical styles, from Negro spirituals to jazz to, more recently, hip-hop, which is fascinating. And there's a YouTube video of me playing a piece written for me by one of the composers who so effectively blends hip-hop and classical, named Daniel Bernard Rumain. And so, in a way, I think we can't understand our American music without understanding the African-American music in the picture, because even our Appalachian music, on which, you know, Copeland and all of those guys drew, what is, traditional so-called Appalachian American fiddle music? Well, it's the music of the West African bowed fiddle, you know, the goje, it has a million different names. You know, those players came over to the U.S., against their will, and started playing. They didn't have their fiddles with them, but they were given the European violin in order to play the music of the British Isles for the plantation owners. So they would play the Irish jigs and the Scottish reels, and then they would play their own African music, and eventually the two styles blended together, and the early uniquely American-sounding fiddlers were the African-American fiddlers, from whom the white fiddlers then learned that style. And it's a story that the traditional fiddle world has done some major research on in the last few decades, but it's still not as widely known as it should be. So even when we think of, you know, these white fiddle styles that the white classical composers then utilize in their classical music, it all goes back to the African-Americans. And, you know, that, I think, is really this interesting piece of the puzzle, is the blending of the European and African in very specific ways that happened here in this country, and then how classical music has been inspired by all of those different sounds all these years.
Wow, you have really thought about that question, haven't you?
Well, actually, the next album, not the next album I'm going to release, because that'll be the Elgar and Brooke Violin Concertos with the BBC Symphony and Andrew Litton in January. And then after that, the Bach Harpsichord and Violin Sonatas with Jory Vinokur. But the next album I'm going to record will be in December and release next October. And that album is going to be entitled Blues Dialogues, and it's going to pay homage to my roots as a lifelong Chicagoan growing up with classical and blues music. But it's going to be specifically African-American composers, both living and historic, whose music draws upon different sounds of the blues in creating their classical language. Now, of course, there's plenty of, actually, the majority of African-American composers don't have any blues or jazz sound in their music at all. So I don't want to perpetuate an erroneous stereotype, but I think this is a very interesting slice of the repertoire that it's really, really fun to play. And so that's what this album, Blues Dialogues, which is actually the name of one of the pieces, is going to be focusing on. So that will be a really fun, actually, I guess that'll be my first specifically American record, other than, of course, my tribute to Maude Powell, which paid homage to a great American, but did include some European music by Sibelius and others, in her own arrangements.
Yeah, we look forward to that album. I just have to say, you kind of opened my eyes a little bit with your response to that question, in that when we sit around with, you know, our hindsight and we try to delineate American music, we tend to exclude. And you're talking about inclusion as far as American music goes. And I think that's a wonderful way to think about it, and just a wonderful way to think about everything.
Absolutely. Well, you know, yeah. I think all of our lives benefit from diversity, and we certainly experience that every day with classical music, because we're playing music by composers from all kinds of different countries and all kinds of different eras and all kinds of different personalities. And, you know, whenever I play the Tchaikovsky concerto, I'm exploring the music of a gay guy from Russia from the 1800s. And yeah. It's like, whoa, what's that all about? And, you know, so it's classical music just really brings us all together and definitely reduces the distance between us, which is one of the reasons I believe in it so much.
Yeah. Well, violinist Rachel Barton Pine appearing this weekend with the Toledo Symphony. That's at the Peristyle Friday and Saturday evening at 8 o'clock p.m. You can get your tickets at ToledoSymphony.com. Call up the box office, 419-246-8000. She will be performing that Brahms violin concerto with her Brahms-sanctioned Guarnieri violin as well. So, Rachel, thanks for spending some time with us today here on FM 91. We look forward to having you this weekend.
Great to talk to you as always, and see you soon.